Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and every day this week on Morning Edition, you're hearing audio essays by five Black American thinkers in a series called Dear President, and we've invited the essayists here to discuss their work. We're doing that every day on this show. With me now is the writer Caitlin Greenidge. She's also the author of the novel We Love You, Charlie Freeman, that came out earlier this year. Her essay called Beyond the Veil describes how she felt as one of the only Black teenagers at her small, as she calls it, nominally progressive private high school in Boston. Hi, Caitlin. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And so for people who didn't hear the essay on Morning Edition, you wrote that to be seen and not seen is one of the defining characteristics of Blackness in America. And you tell your story with respect to high school in the context of that. Where do you want to start?
I'll start by saying that I'm mostly building on the work of other thinkers from past times who talk about Blackness and the idea of like double consciousness, the idea that as a Black person in America, you have your own understanding of yourself as an individual with individual wants and needs and all the whole gamut of human emotions that we all have. And then there's how you're usually viewed by dominant society, which is kind of as a very one-dimensional or caricature or even just not really having kind of the same concerns as others. And I think that view is it gets complicated as kind of we move closer to ideals of racial progress. And sometimes that comes out as, you know, if you're a Black woman, it comes out as Black women are so strong. And it can almost come out in sort of like this kind of like positive discrimination way of like Black women are so strong and I could never be as strong as you, but I bet you're so strong that kind of you don't like all these things don't even really matter to you. And of course, the negative of that is, you know, Black people are able to kind of withstand more pain than white people can, or are somehow different in some kind of way. So, the essay is really about that. I was one of the only Black girls in my class at a very small private school where I was a scholarship student, and a lot of my time there was there as both being invisible in that school or feeling invisible, and also sort of being brought out at certain moments.
So there's this moment, like when you say you want to feel invisible, but then the school splashes a picture of you on its catalog.
And yeah, I didn't want to feel invisible. I mean, yeah. I think as any teenager does, you know, as any teenager, you struggle with how much you want to be seen by other people.
You do and you don't.
You do and you don't. But what was kind of a jarring thing was having one's image used as a symbol of either kind of diversity or inclusion that maybe wasn't completely all there.
You felt like a prop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so then clothing and accessories play a role of protector for you, like the veil in the title of your story.
Yes.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Well, in the essay I talk about, I was a pretty – I mean, this high school was for a lot of eccentrics and nerds, and so I definitely fit that description. So one of my ways of kind of responding to that in a wayward teenage way was to try and just start wearing a veil in public, which went over probably as well as you can expect that it did. So when I was thinking about writing this essay, I was thinking, well, what was the impulse behind wanting to do that? And what can I say about that impulse about identity and moving through America?
And so, listeners, we don't have time for many calls, but if you heard Caitlin's essay and you want to ask a question, or for yourself, maybe there's some of you listening right now relating to this, thinking, you know, if you wanted to hide in plain sight, what have you used in your life as tools to do that, to the extent that you wanted to do that, and why? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and maybe in some parallel situations as a person of color or a minority in whatever context, how did you use some kind of tools to hide in plain sight or maybe be seen to the extent that you want it to be seen only, 212-433-9692. The essay series, as of course you know, is called Dear President. Is there a way to hear your essay as a call to Trump in any way?
I don't know necessarily. I mean, I don't know. I don't think so. I think we're looking at a kind of as everybody has been saying for the last week or so, we're in kind of uncharted waters. We're in an unprecedented space. If it's a call to anyone, I think it's a call to voters and people who have supported Trump and those who have felt that they wanted to support his candidacy. And I think it's a call to think about what that actually really means and what does it mean if you take what he's saying completely seriously, and if you believe somebody when they tell you who they are, then what are you going to do next if you're a good person who loves this country, which I think everybody who's debating about this are people who are deeply invested and deeply interested in what this country means.
You called your high school nominally progressive.
Mm-hmm.
You want to delve into that a little bit?
I think there are a lot of spaces in U.S. society. There's a lot of institutions that have kind of glommed on to the language and the look of diversity, but don't really kind of want to do the work of what that means. You know, in the last weeks, people have been talking about, like, what does diversity mean in the media if you don't necessarily have people from other parts of the country or people from other classes or economic backgrounds joining in the conversation, then what really kind of is diversity? So I kind of felt that way in that space as well, that it's easier to pay lip service to a certain ideal than it is to kind of dig down and do the work and actually live beside and engage with people who are fundamentally different from yourself.
Do you think there needs to be a certain critical mass? It sounded like you were, you know, almost alone as a black girl in that school. If a school is going to have any diversity at all, if it's starting as mostly white, I guess is the premise, mm-hmm. There needs to be some kind of critical mass.
I think oftentimes when people talk about diversifying a school or a school district, it's with kind of small numbers of people, and there's a certain threshold when people start to get uncomfortable with having a certain number of students come in, and then you see white parents pull their children out of school and people leaving. In 50 years, America hasn't come up with a solution to that problem. But I do think recognizing that is a real issue and what the mechanics of that are when they're happening in the moment, and being able to name those things as they're happening is a huge part of it, and being able to honestly talk about it. When I was at that school, there were other black students there, but I was definitely the only black girl in my grade for about 3 years going through. I had friends with other students there, and I found ways to support myself, and my mother provided ways to support myself. But I do think there's this larger question of what does it mean if you feel as though your space is being taken over by other people? Mm-hmm. Can you have that honest discussion about whether or not that's actually true, or whether that's more a feeling or assumption that you're making?
Jason in Chatham, you're on WNYC with Caitlin Greenwich. Hi, Jason.
Morning, Brian. Morning, Caitlin.
Good morning.
All right. I'm originally from Jamaica, so I tend to code switch, mm-hmm. but in my public life, and surprisingly, it has helped me throughout high school here when I came here at 17. The idea of blending in because of my color, also I'm a light-skinned Jamaican, mm-hmm. so I tend to code switch, especially when I'm in situations where people start to be very divisive when it comes to race, you know, talking negative about black people or others. And the minute I switch on my accent, mm-hmm. people take a step back and say, "Wait a minute, you're black." I said, "Yes, I am black," mm-hmm. and then the conversation tends to shift. So I use that a lot in my daily life, code switching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know,
You too.
I do too as well. I mean, I think code switching is something that everybody does regardless of race. I think, you know, men talk differently between themselves than they do around women. Women talk differently between themselves than they do around men. It's just a general part of human communication. So I think as we start to think a little bit more deeply about it and we figure out what's happening in that moment when you do that code switch for other people and kind of keeping the conversation going once you've switched the code and seeing how people respond is the way to go.
Jason, can I ask if you like your code switching or if you ever feel like you're being less than yourself because you have to?
I think I do not like it, Ron, Brian. It started for me when I came here right in high school. So my path took me into creative writing. So, you know, I had to do a lot of English classes, a lot of that stuff in college. And the accent was seen as a barrier. They kept saying, oh, you know, could you say it again? Could you say it again? Mm-hmm. Could you say it again? So I had to switch the way I spoke to fit in. But then I spoke and wrote differently. I speak and actually write differently when I'm home or, you know, in just my general day-to-day life. So it's not something that I actually enjoy. And it even became harder to, you know, in my military years. But that's a different story, Brian. So, Coach, I don't think we should have to, and especially in this country, since it's such a multilingual and multicultural country. I don't think we should have to go through it, but we do, you know, unfortunately.
Call back another day and tell us your military story. Jason, thank you very much. And Rena in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rena.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for your show. And Caitlin, thank you for your essay. I look forward to reading. So I'm Indian American, and everything that you're saying really resonates with me. I could never suggest that I had the experience of a Black American woman. But as an Indian American, recently even somebody was just talking to me. My last name is not very complex, but they were saying, I'm not even going to attempt your last name. And we laughed it off. And for me, that's something that continues to come up even now. I moved to New York City from Florida so that I could find more diversity and feel more embraced. I grew up in a very white American area. And I actually just wrote an email for the first time and, like, inspired by words by people who are finally sharing to say, here's how you pronounce my last name, rather than just kind of ducking in the shadows, laughing it off and saying, you can just abbreviate my name. So that's been really important to me. I was just thinking about the veil that you were talking about, Caitlin.
Caitlin, anything?
I mean, I think that's wonderful. I mean, you know, there's that story that floats around or that adage, like if somebody can say Tchaikovsky, they can pronounce your last name. You know, we make exceptions for so many other names that, you know, 100 years ago people assumed or were too difficult to pronounce. So I'm glad that you're doing that. I'm glad you're kind of forcing the issue.
Rena, thanks for chiming in. We have about a minute left. You want to plug your book? I know you have a novel that came out this year. We Love You, Charlie Freeman.
I do, yes. I will plug away. So it's a novel about a Black family from Boston that moves to a nearly all-white town in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts in the early 1990s. And they move there to take part in an experiment where they are teaching sign language to a chimpanzee.
Uh-huh. And did you grow up in that part of Massachusetts yourself?
I'm from Boston. I am a fourth generation Black New Englander. So I'm particularly interested in talking about Black communities and spaces where we assume that they are either invisible or don't exist.
Or the sign language or the chimpanzee metaphors for things?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I wanted to write about this question of language that I think both of the callers talked about, this question of how language can help connect us to people, but also how it can fail us at those moments when we really are trying to connect and to get across how we're feeling or a certain idea.
Caitlin Greenwich, she's the author of the novel We Love You, Charlie Freeman, that came out earlier this year, and the latest of the essayists in WNYC's Dear President series, which continues on Morning Edition tomorrow with another essayist who will then be back on this show later in the morning. Caitlin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Bye.